Greetings, Sun Sounds listeners, and welcome to the Philosopher Program. This is your host, Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer reader, Candy Lewis. And we begin our program with some daily selections from Science of Mind Guide for Spiritual Living. Part of the whole. Only the wholeness of the Divine Absolute exists as the source and the sum of everything that could exist. Ivan Antic, The Physics of Consciousness. Humanity is made up of innumerable individuals, no two alike, and yet society is a complete whole, moving gradually forward towards some ultimate goal. Ernest Holmes, This Thing Called You. Isn't this great, coming to the awareness that we are all part of the whole? As we take time to recognize our surroundings, we see we are part of the trees. We are one with the birds flying in the air. We are one with our neighbors and our coworkers. It is beautiful to think that we each are connected with this thing called life. This thing called life has really set us up to achieve great things. Being part of the whole means we have the whole universe behind us. As we think about what we desire and then put intention to make that desire manifest, the whole universe backs our desires. Why? Because we are part of the whole. Here's a question for you. Knowing you are backed by the universe, what good are you going to present to the world today? Knowing you cannot fail, what dreams, visions, and gifts are you willing to share with the world? Once you say yes to being the conduit for the fulfillment of your dreams and visions, know you are divinely supported. The only thing you are called to do is to show up. Oh, and one more thing. You've got this. Affirmation. I am supported by the universe. I declare that all my desires are manifesting now. I am one with the all. Freedom is a state of mind. Yeshua said, if you know the truth shall make you free. Ignorance is a slave. Knowledge is freedom. The Gospel of Philip. You are now free, and your freedom will yet save the world from itself. Ernest Holmes, Creative Mind. Freedom is a state of mind. As such, no one can take our freedom away from us. Even when we find ourselves in situations where our physical body appears to be in bondage, our thoughts of freedom keep us free. That mind that frees us is the same mind that can keep us in bondage. Remember, we are free to think what we want, and our thoughts create our experiences. We have been given the beautiful gift of choice. We are free to choose what we think. And since what we think about, we bring about, let's be clear about what it is we want to experience. In this, you choose your freedom. In this lies your freedom of choice. Choose to be free of thoughts of negativity, lack, and limitation. Choose to be free of thoughts of not being enough. Choose to be free of thoughts of fear, doubt, and worry. Some may ask how to do this. Simply put, make the choice to do it. We are free to choose thoughts of abundance. We are free to choose thoughts of peace. We are free to choose thoughts of love, confidence, and grace. You are free to be the divine, brilliant illumination of pure spirit. Today is the day to let your spirit fly free. Affirmation. I claim my freedom now. I am the brilliant illumination of spirit. I freely give my gifts and talents. And from the Daily Word, published by Unity, Holy. The presence of God, of spirit, of the universe surrounds me. Wherever I stand is holy ground. I've heard it said there are only two ways to live your life. One is as though nothing is a miracle. The other is as though everything is a miracle. When I have eyes to see miracles unfolding all around me, the entire world becomes a holy place. The world is not different, but I am. Opening my heart and looking through eyes of awe and reverence, I behold God, Spirit, the universe, all around me, in the beauty and diversity of the natural world, in the creativity of art and engineering marvels, and in kind acts and harmonious interactions. Finding holiness everywhere changes me at depth. As I deepen in awareness of the presence and power of God, of Spirit, of the universe, in the world, I can more easily find it in myself and my fellow spiritual beings. We are one in God. We are holy. Faith. My faith is my foundation. Every good thing, every blessing in my life began with faith. All that I had worked to achieve, everything I had dreamed of, everything I had prayed for, began with my belief it could happen. Even if I have faced setbacks or had to wait for my good to come to me, I held firm to my faith. I understand all manifestation is divinely ordered, and certain things must fall into place before I can realize my dream or fulfill my goal. Living a life of faith keeps God, Spirit, the universe, foremost in my mind and heart. A constant reminder, my greatest truth and highest blessing is to live a spiritual life. I believe in the absolute goodness of God, of Spirit, of the universe, and in myself as a faith-filled spiritual being, infinitely blessed and worthy of realizing my dreams. And from Mark Nepos, The Book of Awakening, Having the Life You Want by Being Present to the Life You Have, When Feeling Stuck. The same stream of life that runs through the world runs through my veins. Rabindranath Tagore. We are so achievement-oriented that we often surge right by the true value of relating to what's before us, because we think that accomplishing things will complete us, when it is in experiencing life that will. Yet, if we can outlast the urge to judge everything we encounter, a miracle starts to surround us in which painting, music, poetry, running water, flowers, wind through trees, open vistas, all touch and draw out their counterpart that lives quietly within us. The 19th century poet Gerard Manley Hopkins called this inner terrain inscape. And just as no landscape can flourish without sun and water, our inscape must be irrigated and drenched with many forms of life if we are to thrive. So, when feeling stuck or disconnected from the miracle of life, as will happen to us all, try to listen, see, feel, and just take in. Try to let the energies of life stir their counterparts within you. In order to be whole, suspend your criticism, for life is not a matter of taste, but of awakening, not a matter of finding things pleasing or disturbing, but of finding things completing, not a matter of liking or disliking, but of opening the geography of one's soul. This is a meditation done to music. Close your eyes and listen to a piece of music that is new to you. As you breathe evenly, allow yourself to feel your like or dislike for it, and try to let that go. As you breathe, allow yourself to meet the sheer energy of the music with the sheer energy of what is new in you. We return now to Science of Mind for Reverend Emile Gavreau's monthly column, Law of Circulation. Circulation, the Art and Practice. On one of his Alive Again recordings, Ernest Holmes is heard saying, "If you want love, be loving. If you want friends, be friendly." In this context, I would say, if you want to receive, be giving. Everybody knows this, right? Have you thought about where you give from? When you make your gift or tithe, are you giving from obligation and guilt, or to impress others with the size of your gift? Or are you giving from a place of gratitude for everything that has been placed in your stewardship? Or are you giving simply from the joy of having a bounty from which to make such a gift? Tithing to your spiritual center or donating to an organization like the Science of Mind Foundation is an act of gratitude. Gratitude and circulation are of the same energy. We are talking about taking on the attitude of a happy giver, someone who knows that as they share, so shall they receive. A happy giver receives gratefully and joyfully, such that the bounty of the universe is poured on them, pressed down, and overflowing. The true nature of the universe is an infinite flow available all the time to everyone. Happy, grateful, joyous givers align themselves through gratitude with this infinite source and flow. In the process of expanding your capacity for gratitude and joy, you expand the space into which you can receive from the universe. The universe, in turn, is always seeking to fill these spaces. Thus, when you grow in your capacity to receive, you create a vacuum which is filled via the universe's imperative to fill each and every vacuum. In truth, we are not giving or receiving. We are simply circulating the infinite energy of the universe in all its various forms. Those things that we believe to be ours have actually just been momentarily assigned to our good stewardship. As you and I demonstrate our ability to be good stewards, the universe gifts us with the blessing of more of its bounty to steward and circulate. As you enter into this new year, add to your spiritual practice the gratitude for all you have already received, the joy that you are in a position to give from this already existing bounty, and the happiness that comes from the awareness that you are living, moving, and having your being in the infinite. And from the same issue, an article by Ernest Holmes, The Whole Human Family. Everyone wishes to have a friend and to be a friend, and everyone wants to be happy. Surely it is intended that we all live together in peace and prosperity, and there is a way through which this can be brought about. Let us then think about some of the things we must do to bring about peace on earth and goodwill among humans. First of all, we must do away with race prejudice, for there's really only one race, which is the human race. And while we're all different, we all belong to this one human family. We must learn to respect each other, to know of the needs of the other person, and to realize that at the base of every person's life, there is a sincere desire to love and be loved. There's a lot more good in the world than we realize, and it is this good in each other that we wish to bring out. Sometimes we feel that if we could change the world in a minute through some miracle of love, all would be well. And this is true, but the world is made up of the people who live in it, and that means you and me. So each will have to begin right where they are. You will have to begin where you are, and I will have to begin where I am right now, today. Sowing the world together with faith. Haven't you often met someone just in passing and said to yourself, if I knew this person better, I'm sure that I would admire them? Perhaps we're just a little too timid. Perhaps there isn't quite enough give and take in life. We are all so much alike inside. We all want people to like us, and we want to feel that we enter into their lives in some vital way. We all have the same needs, the same hopes and longings. It doesn't matter that we have different opinions, for we are all individuals. Each is a person in their own right, and unity does not mean uniformity. But unity does mean that we get along as a human family. It is not the different opinions that we need be concerned with, but how to get along with each other in one world. The problem begins right at home, in your mind and in mine. Have we kindness for others? Are we flexible enough to know that everyone doesn't have to think alike in order to get along? Are we able to put ourselves in the other's place? Can we overlook the irritations of life and reach across all differences of opinion to the common ground on which we all stand and the united purpose toward which we all strive? It seems as though one part of the world is trying to destroy everything, while the other part is trying to sew it together again. The people who are trying to sew the world together again are those of a larger vision and a deeper faith. Today, they are the hope of humanity. You may be certain that those who are trying to tear the world apart have but little faith in God, in spirit, in the universe. And those who are trying to put it together again have a deep conviction that there is a spiritual power that could operate in human affairs if we would let it. I cannot help but believe these are the ones who will finally win. You cannot separate what is best in the world from some kind of faith in this thing called life. And somewhere along the line, what is best is bound to win. But it can win only as more and more people come to believe in it, as more and more people come to live as though it were true. And since we act the way we think, the most needed thing in the world today is that more people shall come to believe in God, in spirit, in the universe. For God is the great common denominator of the whole human family. We live and move and have our being in a divine presence that, if we would let it, could guide us all aright. Creating a world of unity. No two persons need think or act alike. Each is an individual. The rosebush is not a grapevine, nor is someone from China a New Englander. But the rosebush and the grapevine are rooted in one common soil. They draw their whole being from it. And the Chinese and the New Englanders are rooted in one divine mind, which has seen fit to make each a little different while keeping them all in its own spirit. There is plenty of room for variety in groups and in nations, different thoughts and ideas, different ways of living, different political, economic, and cultural systems. We need this variety. But back of it all, we need a sympathy and an understanding with each other, just because we are all human beings. It isn't necessary in the immediate family that each member think and act alike. there may be four sons and four daughters, and each may go into a different profession. And this is exactly as it should be, for this is the way God, Spirit, the universe, made us. But there's a spirit of helpfulness and cooperation in a happy family that promotes the well-being of each member, permitting each to be a little different, while all the same time finding common purposes back of their united action. So it is in the larger family of the human race. We are individuals wherever we go. The thing that makes for unity is that each group shall respect the individual differences of other groups while at the same time cooperating with them. This is not only possible but necessary if the world is to survive. I feel we each have an individual part in this great scheme of things, and that the most valuable thing any one of us can do today is for each to be a little more certain that they are meeting life with a deeper understanding and sympathy for others, with a greater love for all. I don't believe this is merely an idle sentiment or a wistful wishing. It is practical. More and more of our great leaders in education, religion, and science are coming to accept this position, and they are right. So you and I want to take our part in the building of a better world, a world where there is peace, prosperity, and goodwill without coercion, a world where there is individual and collective security and freedom without fear, a world where there is unity without uniformity, a world where each may run as fast and as far as they wish without interfering with somebody else. I believe it is the destiny of our great country to preserve freedom, prosperity, and cooperation. I believe it is the destiny of America to remain a democracy and, in following the leading of the divine spirit, to preserve human freedom, while at the same time creating an opportunity for everyone. I believe it is the greatness of America to rise above the prejudice of race and creed, for there is but one race, which is the human race, and but one final creed, which is our common belief in God, in spirit, in the universe. I believe it is the faith of America to keep this high vision ever before it. This is the American spirit. I like to call it the spirit of God in America. And this, I want to point out, was originally created in 1950. And here is a meditation from Dr. Ernest Holmes. Let us take as the thought for our meditation today, wherefore, putting away lying, every person speaks truth with their neighbor, for we are members of one another. And as we turn to that divine power within and around us, let us feel a deep sense of consecration to the Spirit within us and to the God in all people, as each says quietly, I believe in the union of God with humanity. I believe in the need we all have for each other. I believe that the Spirit is acting through me in love and in harmony with others. And I believe that the same Spirit in others is reacting to me in love and in harmony. I believe we are all one family in God, in spirit, in the universe, and that God is working in each one of us in such a way as to produce a better world. I am willing to be guided. I am glad to be led of the Spirit, and I rejoice in the thought that all people live in God, in spirit, in the universe, that we all may be guided by the Spirit. I am seeking and finding love and friendship everywhere I go, in everyone I meet, in every situation in which I find myself. And thou, who doest all things devise and fashion for the best, help us, who see with mortal eyes, to overlook the rest. And from the same issue, Reverend Dr. David Alexander's monthly column, Philosophy in Action, Radical Oneness. In this month's feature by Ernest Holmes, we uncover a remarkable gem from the Science of Mind archives from 1950. In it, Holmes lays out the case for unity and a path for peace in our world. He calls for the elimination of prejudice and discrimination of every kind, including that based on race or creed. The formula he offers for making a more peaceful world begins with respect, grounded in an understanding of our oneness. It is what I've often referred to as the radical implications of our philosophy, or theology, or teaching, if you prefer. The radical implication of professing to adhere to the principle of oneness is that you and I are called to walk the talk of actually respecting all life and creation because you are one with it. Let that sink in for a moment. The real work of oneness goes well beyond singing, chanting, and praying affirmatively. It extends to befriending those whom we consider to be the other. Our spiritual principles teach that we are inextricably linked to one another, that we are all unique expressions of the one divine source. As such, the human family expresses in an unlimited and unique array of opinions, preferences, and forms of identity. Our oneness does not mean sameness. Rather, our oneness implies diversity and therefore calls on us to celebrate, respect, and lift up our uniqueness as an act of affirming our oneness in spirit. In other words, it is because we are one in spirit that I honor and celebrate the unique expression you are. While we may have different opinions, values, and ideas, we are not different, only different expressions of the same spirit. Befriending the other becomes a daily spiritual practice and a way in which we embody our philosophy. In a very real and practical sense, my spiritual liberation and freedom of expression are tied up in yours. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. said it like this: I cannot become what I ought to be unless you become what you ought to be. You cannot become what you ought to be unless I become what I ought to be. We are bound together in a single garment of destiny. Travel well. We turn now to an article in the January-February 2025 issue of Spirituality and Health, a Unity publication. Splintered Pieces by Nancy Wilburn, Ph.D. Seeing her father in the psych ward seemed all wrong until her inner guidance helped her see it as exquisitely right. When a tragedy hits, it's normal to think that the actual event is what causes us pain. And of course it does. Losing a child or a spouse or a home or being diagnosed with a debilitating disease would all be life-altering events that would boggle our minds and break our hearts. The accompanying feelings of loss, grief, panic, rage, and resentment all need to be honored and held with compassion. But as a therapist, and as a person who has experienced my own life-stopping events, I have come to realize that much of the depth of our suffering comes from how such events violate our assumptions about life and who we know ourselves to be. This was brought home to me most poignantly the first day I went to visit my father in a geriatric psych unit. After being escorted past two security checkpoints, I heard the clicking release of the lock. As I stepped through the doorway, I left the world of the familiar and entered a space of splintered glass. Daddy was sitting in his wheelchair next to a round table in the common area. Other patients were scattered around the room. I found a vacant chair and moved it next to Daddy. He looked up at me and smiled in recognition through his medically induced fog. As soon as I sat down, a friendly man sitting across the table offered an unexpected greeting. "Hey, you," he exclaimed. "Hey, you, come over here. What kind of shoes you got, lady?" "I got better shoes than that," he said, campaigning for my attention like a sideshow barker. I nodded and smiled in his direction and returned my attention to Daddy, noticing chocolate icing smeared on the front of his shirt. My stomach clenched. My heart ached. I kept reminding myself to remain calm and keep my focus on Daddy. A moment later, a disheveled elderly woman in a frayed T-shirt sat down next to me. "So what do you think about him?" "He got out his Bible and was preaching to me. He was preaching to me," she reiterated. "I told him to get the hell out of here," she continued, angrily gesturing toward the door. She scooted her chair closer, her gaze now only inches from the side of my face. "Wouldn't you be angry with him if he did that to you?" she asked. I turned toward her briefly and offered, "You're really angry with him, aren't you?" trying to join her for a moment and reflect her feelings back to her, wherever she was. Sitting in my chair next to Daddy, I became overwhelmed in this unsettling milieu. A man trying to sell me shoes, a woman ranting in anger, another one lying back in an adult-sized infant carrier, incessantly moaning, a former college professor writing nothings in the air, a motherly baby boomer yelling obscenities, Tourette style. And then there was a woman shaking the handle of the unit door, repeatedly screaming, "Get me out of here! Get me out of here! Somebody get me out of here!" Her cry provided the backdrop to the whole jangled space, like a loud, heavy metal guitar refrain. I didn't blame her. I wanted out of there, too. The only familiar anchor to reality in that disjointed space was the sound of Bob Barker's voice coming from the TV, beckoning, "Come on down!" That and Daddy's gentle blue eyes. My stomach knotted in response to the adrenaline rushing through my veins. My whole body reacted as if I had just stepped into some Twilight Zone thriller, except it was worse. This horror show was not a movie. These patients were not actors. This was the real deal. I was actually walking into an altered reality. My skin prickled and my heart raced. My emotions leaped and flipped and ran into each other like a cage full of monkeys vying for rungs on a jungle gym. I started silently screaming out to God my most frantic prayer. Help me, help me, help me. I felt fear, shock, grief, guilt, helplessness, and deep, deep sadness as my mind struggled desperately to find a way to put these splintered pieces all together. No, I thought, this is all wrong. This should not be happening, not to him. It was as if some giant invisible hand had plucked my father from his life and randomly placed him here. But it was happening, and it was happening to him. Now what? I wondered. When visiting hours were over, I gave Daddy a hug and drove home, crying all the way. Accepting the unacceptable. At home, I picked up right where I had left off, aimlessly walking around the house screaming, no! But at some point, I began to notice something new arising into my awareness. One of my favorite quotes, a question often attributed to Einstein but kept echoing in the back of my mind. Is the universe a friendly place or is it not? From where I stood, the answer to that question was an emphatic no. In that moment, all that I could see looking back on the day was a collection of disjointed lost souls. All that I could hear were the rantings of the mad. This did not look friendly to me. No way. Right in the middle of all my resistance, however, another part of me knew enough to just breathe, to get still and quiet. In the stillness, I noticed that between each resistant no was a gap, an open, unfettered space. I walked over to my computer and silently repeated one of my constant prayers, one that is more honest and humble than my earlier desperate plea of help me. I whispered, I know nothing. Show me. Immediately, I heard a familiar inner voice coming out of the openness like a portal into wisdom. Nancy, when you believe the universe cannot be trusted to be loving, you will have no other choice but to see the grotesque and to hear the wails of the tortured. From this viewpoint, there is no other conclusion besides this should not be happening. But if you dare to give some space before answering the question of whether the universe is a friendly place or not, more light can come in and more details can be brought to the foreground. We would paint another picture here. The part of your dad who was wise and compassionate, who walked with dignity, is already gone. He had no need to cling. The part that you see here is the remnant of the cloth. This is the part that is too afraid, too proud to let go. Can you not give him the time and the space to take his pride to its bitter end? He's playing it out, Nancy, to see if it will hold him up. Can you allow him his dignity in the middle of this seeming hell? And there is more. Can you also see that this disturbing situation is inviting you to notice what you are clinging to as well? Why is this situation with your father on your plate? That is the question. Instead of looking at your dad and then shouting, this should not be happening, stop, take a breath, and see if you can be the love you so desperately want to hold him and the others. Can you surrender? Can you trust? Can you let go and let it all be perfect just the way it is? It's all perfect, Nancy, all of it. You just have to have the eyes to see it. These words stunned my mind and stretched my heart. They were so not me, and yet they rang so true. The me I knew myself to be literally came to a stop, and that's when the miracle happened, an elegant epiphany. Somewhere deep inside myself, I saw that every disjointed thing I'd experienced in that room, including Daddy and me, the better shoes over here guy, the professor writing nothings in the air, the woman complaining about the Bible thumper, the let me out of here railings, and Bob Barker's familiar beckoning call, come on down. Each one was like a splintered piece of colored glass falling together in a unique and beautiful pattern as if in some kind of cosmic kaleidoscope. With each turn of the cylinder, with each unexpected turn of events, all the shards of glass shifted into position, relocating in relation to each other. With each rotation, a brand new harmonious mandala of wholeness effortlessly fell into place, more inclusive and creative than I could ever have imagined. Nothing changed on the outside after I heard the inner voice and saw that vision of wonder. Daddy wasn't suddenly healed. He stayed in the psych ward for 3 weeks to get his meds regulated and was then moved to a nursing home, where he lived for one more year, steadily declining into dementia. The sadness of that remained, but the intense suffering from my deep resistance to it was released, and I was able to live in peace, trusting that the universe is always working on our behalf, regardless of the form it takes. Of course, over time, I would lose touch with that knowing, but just as assuredly, I would return to it over and over again. We pause for a moment to remind you that you are listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, 24 hours of programming from over 300 publications, and you are currently listening to the Philosopher Program with your host, Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer reader, Candy Lewis. You can take Sun Sounds with you. You can get our stream and on demand on our new Sun Sounds of Arizona app for Apple and Android phones. We return now to Soul Boom, Why We Need a Spiritual Revolution by Rainn Wilson. And we are nearing the end of this book. We are at the end of Chapter 10, The Seven Pillars of a Spiritual Revolution. Virtuous Education. Here are some of the things I learned in school. How to be an effective crossing guard. How to make a paper snowflake. How to write in cursive. How to find a book using the Dewey Decimal System. How to square dance. How to make finger puppets, dioramas, and pretty much anything from paper mache, how to recite the state capitals, lists of presidents, and obscure facts about Washington state history, and, believe it or not, because this was the 1970s, how to properly dive under your desk in case of a nuclear attack. Here's how many of those I put into use in any kind of regular way. The nuclear desk one. Other than that, mostly useless. Now, I understand that education is a complicated thing. Many assigned tasks, learning the periodic table or trigonometry, for instance, that we may not use very much in our daily lives, have tremendous value because the act of learning them does wonders for the growth of our rapidly developing brains. But perhaps, just perhaps, we're doing some essential things completely wrong when it comes to education. Because when you ask people what they wish they had been taught in school, the lists are illuminating. Here are a few topics that top various lists. How to take care of one's mental health. How to take care of one's financial health, i.e. banking, finance, debt management, investing, saving money, and monthly budgeting. How to deal with mistakes, failures, and rejection. How to use social media safely and healthily. How to meditate. How to buy and maintain a car. How to sustain relationships. How to manage time and how to focus. How to apply and interview for jobs. How to communicate effectively. How to grow a garden. A delightful combination of the totally practical cars and the abstract psychosocial failure. I find the fact that the things in the above list are not taught to adolescents disappointing and frustrating. We come out of school knowing the quadratic equation, although fewer than a third of eighth graders have grade-level math fluency, but not how to balance a checkbook. We know the internal organs of the frog, but not how to apply for a job. All this being said, there's an altogether different subject of skills that I believe every child should be not only taught, but diligently encouraged to master: spiritual virtues. I mentioned the importance and relevance of virtues earlier in the book, remember? In the death chapter, when I discussed my idea for a revised game of life, a brief refresher. From a completely spiritual perspective, virtues are those attributes of the divine that we seek to cultivate in our hearts and through our actions. They are ineffable traits that we take with us when we exit this material plane. Soul qualities, characteristics that one thinks of when pondering God and the beautiful effulgence of his holiest of teachers, such as the Buddha and Jesus. Here's a refresher. Kindness, humility, compassion, generosity, mercy, trustworthiness, sincerity, tenderness, patience, wisdom, love. Spiritual attributes can also be categorized as qualities that describe how one pursues one's goals and undertakes actions. For instance, determination, imaginativeness, confidence, cheerfulness, cleanliness, resilience, self-discipline, enthusiasm, flexibility. I get why some might recoil when they hear the word virtues. For some people, the word might be associated with Sunday school or a certain brand of Christian philosophy and the way that orthodoxy was sometimes taught. Some might think some kind of religious indoctrination is associated with them. For those of you who have this reaction, I simply ask that you reframe the phrase spiritual virtues by defining these same attributes as character traits, positive qualities, or even, for the more practically business-minded, leadership skills. Everyone loves a positive leadership quality, right? Regardless of whether one is religious or not. We like leaders who are honest, trustworthy, kind. We admire people who are courageous and humble. We emulate those in our lives who are wise and compassionate. Most people know someone with real character when they meet them. And I'm sure we all have people in our families who are naturally patient or curious or loving or creative. I believe all children are born with these attributes to some degree. That's the miracle of these behavioral habits. I also believe they are universal. Although their importance might vary a bit from culture to culture, throughout the world, humans are drawn to essentially the same list of positive character assets. It's why all parents, even those without religious affiliations, frequently report wanting to raise their children to be kind, loving, responsible adults. Some of these virtues come naturally, and others we need to work on. My wife, for instance, is almost outrageously compassionate toward everyone. She deeply connects with how others might be feeling, like she's some kind of alien empath. Me? Not so much. Some personality assets we might naturally develop over time. For instance, I'm much more gentle and less aggressive now than I was in my 20s or 30s. But then again, I'm super duper old. However, it is a gross mistake to think that spiritual virtues can't be taught and that instead of being trained or coached, they're learned through a kind of sociocultural osmosis. But unfortunately, this is what the majority of the population seems to believe. Sure, in school, teachers might give the occasional lecture about how important honesty is when someone steals a couple dollars from the cupcake fund. And yes, parents involve themselves to varying degrees in the character development of their children. Some might occasionally work with their kids and point out positive qualities in others they have interacted with. Oftentimes, certain virtues, such as cleanliness and courteousness, are highlighted regularly. Still, others might, each through negative feedback, don't be so impatient, don't call your sister names, clean up your room. Aristotle defined it like this: virtue means doing the right thing in relation to the right person, at the right time, to the right extent, in the right manner, and for the right purpose. And I believe that we can all learn to follow Aristotle's definition to an ever-increasing degree. But collectively, we seem to not believe that spiritual virtues or positive character traits are something that need to be actively cultivated through instruction and guidance. I'm here to tell you they can be. And not only that, but it's also imperative that we turn our attention to a lifelong pursuit of spiritual virtues education, especially if we ultimately want a true spiritual soul boom revolution. Harvard philosopher Michael Sandel describes their use as similar to working out. Altruism, generosity, solidarity, and civic spirit are not like commodities that are depleted with use. They're more like muscles that develop and grow stronger with exercise. One of the defects of a market-driven society is that it lets these virtues languish. To renew our public life, we need to exercise them more strenuously. I experienced this firsthand. I was involved for many years in helping to lead a diverse youth group in a fun, Baha'i-inspired series of empowerment courses called the Junior Youth Spiritual Empowerment Program. In this terrific series of books that we used, we engaged young folks ages 11 to 15 in many deep and difficult conversations around some profound moral quandaries. A focus on character building through the lens of developing virtues was also a core part of the curriculum, and I witnessed that aspect of the program having a tremendous effect on the students. Let's say, for example, that our virtue of the week was generosity. We would study it, learn about it, read stories about it, provide examples of times we had seen it in the real world, and then we would task the students with observing that same virtue throughout the course of the following week. When we would next meet, we'd go around the circle and share stories about generosity that we had witnessed. We would also share examples of times we were generous ourselves. And then, having that quality in our virtues tool belt, we'd move on to another virtue for the upcoming week. I was amazed over the course of a few months of doing this work how the language, energy, and power of this type of character education began to seep into all aspects of the work and the conversations at large. We would use the language of virtues on a regular basis. When we read a story, the first question we asked would be, what spiritually rich personality traits were shown by the characters in the story? If someone would ask a question, the kids would support them by saying something to the effect of, great way of expressing curiosity. If someone brought cookies to a fellow student whose cat had died, their compassion was complimented. If someone helped clean up, we would all comment on their quality of helpfulness. Before too long, we saw behavior improve and mature. We also witnessed regular evidence of the pleasure a young person might receive in being kind, respectful, joyful, and humble. And where does this all lead? To values, to real identity, and ultimately, to character with a capital C. What do you value in others, and what do you value in yourself? What are your character defects, and how, by focusing on the spiritual virtue that needs attention, can you transform those deficits into character assets? By continuously using the language of virtues, we create a strategy for empowering the best in kids as well as in ourselves. If we want a spiritual revolution, we need to arm ourselves, our children, and our youth with all the tools they will need in this endeavor as they walk along the kung fu path of the spiritual activist. These tools are not prioritized in our present-day world, but they should be. They work both on a mystical level, revealing the divine light of the Creator, and on an utterly practical one, making our lives richer and our efforts more successful. It is important to note that virtues not only build character on an individual level, but also create a social condition in which all human beings can flourish and live their very best and most vital lives. When one is in alignment with these special qualities, qualities that illumine the very best aspects of what it means to be a human, both children and adults become more fulfilled, and the environment they inhabit becomes a safe and radiant space in which they can thrive. And isn't that what we truly need? Of all these magnificent qualities, compassion may well be the most crucial, powerful, and transformative. Radical compassion. Infamous movie critic and cinema legend Roger Ebert once labeled films empathy machines. In the stories we see on the screen, we see ourselves reflected right back at us. We're allowed to walk in another person's shoes for about 112 minutes and experience the world the way they do. In the best examples, we're allowed to take in the reality of what it's like to be in captivity in 12 Years a Slave, or to be someone with facial abnormalities, as in Mask or Wonder, or to be caught in the middle of a Jewish pogrom in stories as diverse in tone as Fiddler on the Roof and Schindler's List, or occasionally to see the world as a frequently misunderstood, wildly attractive paper salesman slash beet farmer. But is film really an empathy machine? Does it work as one? Have we become more emotionally attuned to others over the last 100 and some years since film was invented? We certainly know what it's like to be Michael Corleone or Forrest Gump, or what choices we would have made in a Squid Game, but have we viewers changed our behavior in any way because of the insights film has given us into the consciousness, emotional and otherwise, of people who are different from us? In a similar vein, virtual reality was supposed to bring about the advent of greater cognitive and emotional empathy. In fact, in France, they recently did a trial use of virtual reality with men who were perpetrators of domestic abuse to try and increase their emotional understanding of what it might feel like to be a victim in those situations. They put the men right in the middle of a violent domestic conflict, but from the point of view of the woman or child, in 3D vision and surround sound. The results, from what I could determine, were inconclusive, but the idea is fascinating and has a great deal of potential. I want to take this idea further than film and VR. What if we humans were able to build ourselves the ultimate compassion machine? Imagine if part of one's educational experience was an emotional empathy training program that involved an immersive experience of witnessing the life or consciousness of someone quite different from you, vis-a-vis some kind of virtual device. An experience greater than a movie and even more effective than VR that fed directly into the sensory and feeling areas of your brain. Maybe it would require wires on your skull. Perhaps it would be like sliding into an MRI tube filled with monitors. I'll let your imagination come up with the technology, but the result would be to experience the emotional life of another human in such a way that we physiologically and psychologically undergo the reality of their suffering and want to alleviate it. And imagine if, as part of our educational journey, we were required to spend many hours in this compassion machine relating to dozens of different subjects all around the planet. People who are incredibly different from us. A queer kid getting bullied on a playground and crying around a corner, wiping their bloody nose. A Haitian laborer traveling to the Florida Keys on a makeshift raft in the noonday sun, longing to see his children back home. A woman giving birth in Sudan with no water anywhere around. A Ukrainian soldier who had lost his entire family, shivering in a trench, waiting for artillery to land. A scared child singing a song while hunting boar for the very first time in a remote jungle somewhere. You know what? Now that I think about it, this whole endeavor I described could make a terrific sci-fi film. Imagine if, through this systematic, deeply virtual educational technology, humans were able to fundamentally conjoin with experiences outside of the normal ken of our daily lives and the lives of our local tribe, and consequently emotionally mature. What if humanity, through this method, took a gigantic leap toward world peace with the help of our compassion machine? We would eventually get to a point where we simply could not stand to allow the suffering of any of our fellow human brothers and sisters. Good news, we already have this machine, each and every one of us. And guess what? At risk of being totally corny, it's called the human heart. If we train this pulsating muscle, use it more frequently, focus on it, harness its power, we can join in a very similar, precious, and profound union with someone less fortunate than us. Someone a world away. Now, you might notice that I've specifically been using the word compassion and not empathy or some other words that might seem to mean the same thing. Let's explore. The Harvard Business Review's Potential Project actually published a breakdown of the words we use to describe our understanding of another person's experience. In a rough way, it's like this. Pity is the lowest form of this understanding. It is the experience of I feel sorry for you, which to me also implies someone holding oneself above others. Sympathy is the sensation of I feel for you, the passive response of that's rough to someone's pain that feels superficial in its emotional connection. Empathy is closer, expressing the idea of I feel with you. But in my personal experience, empathy is a heart-based reaction to what another person might be going through, i.e. you cry when you see a friend cry because you feel their pain, but that's where it stops. Compassion is described as, I feel with you and I am here to help. It captures the most significant willingness to provide support and action to relieve another's suffering. True compassion, in other words, transcends empathy, because if you are experiencing compassion, you are driven to action to alleviate the pain. And that's exactly what humanity needs right now. I would argue this human/divine virtue is our most surprising superpower. Radical compassion is somewhere between the divine and the practical. It's a pragmatic and commonsensical way to build emotional bridges between parties that wouldn't normally intersect. And at the same time, it's one of the most transcendent of spiritual qualities that cries out for a life-altering opening of the heart. Compassion is both the most human of emotions and the most sublime. And like all virtues, it is a muscle in the chest that can be trained, nurtured, and honored. If the notorious G.O.D. is able to hold us in his gaze, in the palm of his hand, metaphorically, with nothing but utter love and forgiveness, my hope is that this is something we can emulate one to another right here on old planet Earth. And why radical compassion? Because regular old compassion just ain't cutting it. We must expand the number of people we are able to deeply feel with and want to help, as well as increase the depth of the feeling itself. Until finally the intensity of that feeling, like water bursting through a dam, leads to real transformative action. Regular compassion pauses at the point of empathy, while radical compassion demands action. And finally, seeking to relieve other people's suffering ultimately requires the pursuit of justice. The best beloved of all things in my sight is justice, writes Baha'u'llah. Turn not away therefrom, if thou desirest me. The Dalai Lama is the living embodiment of this concept. He has a daily practice of compassion for the Chinese invaders who killed 1 million of his fellow Tibetans during their annexation of their territory, while at the same time forcing many of the residents to become atheists, to burn holy books, and renounce their elders. He says it perfectly. Real compassion comes from seeing the suffering of others. You feel a sense of responsibility, and you want to do something for them. And finally, His Holiness sums the whole thing right up when he says, if you want others to be happy, practice compassion. If you want to be happy, practice compassion. Italics mine. Science confirms this wisdom to be true. In a study of 1,000 people over 7 years reported in the Journal of Translational Psychology, researchers found that higher levels of compassion toward others versus toward self predicted statistically better physical and mental health outcomes in 9 out of 10 adults. As a matter of fact, Matthew Ricard, a 76-year-old Tibetan Buddhist monk, has been called the happiest man in the world. Why? Because during brain scans, his happiness levels were off the charts and broke every previous record. And what was he doing when he achieved the highest recorded level of happiness? Why, a meditation that focuses on compassion for all of humanity, of course. And there's the payoff. All this radical compassion for others and the actions we then undertake comes right back around and helps us with our own sense of inner bliss, a vitally needed source of individual and personal rocket fuel that can help kindle and sustain our desperately needed spiritual revolution. And there you have it, a compendium of some concepts we might draw on for our global transformative revolution, some spiritual solutions for some spiritual problems, pillars to build on. As I said, we're really going to need a few dozen more of these that have been fleshed out to a far greater extent and to a far more exacting degree, but it's a start. Because when I examine under the hood of the car of humanity, what I find is, damn it, I just can't do it anymore. I need to find a better analogy. Pauses. Okay, found one. But you're going to need to read the conclusion to find out what it is. In conclusion, when we try to pick out anything by itself, we find it hitched to everything else in the universe. John Muir. In conclusion, are you kidding me? It's impossible to have some kind of conclusion to this soul boom thingamajig. There's no conceivable way to wrap up with a tidy little summary the topics we've been tossing about, mulling over, and digging around in for almost 254 pages. I mean, give me a break. As proof of this, I offer a brief recap. We dove into God and 70s TV shows. Together, we tackled the entirety of religion and even tried to build a new amazing one along the way. We explored all things profound, consciousness, the sacred and the profane, the existential need for poetry. We dug into the spiritual phenomenon of death and what aliens might be saying about our civilization. And to top it all off, we examined global pandemics, diagnosed most everything that is broken about contemporary society, and laid out 7 foundational concepts for a spiritual revolution. There is simply no way on the notorious G.O.D.'s Green Earth that I will be able to sum up the epic, rambling, sometimes profound, and sometimes ridiculous conversation we've been engaged in. But fine, I'll try. In 1918, Harvard University's medical school began a study that followed a group of 268 men for 80 years. Called the Grant Study, this long-term comprehensive investigation was focused on one question: what makes a good life? In the study, everything was accounted for. Data was gathered on health, psychology, marriage and children, behavioral choices, resilience in dealing with stress, diet, exercise, and, as the subjects got toward the end of their lives, retirement. All of it was sifted through and analyzed to try and determine what allows us to live happy, contented, and fulfilled lives. The data points and insights that were gathered were rumored to have filled rooms. There were many aha takeaways. But at the end of the day, the principal researcher, psychiatrist Dr. George Valiant, summed up all the findings with a single sentence: the only thing that really matters in life are your relationships to other people. I find that summation incredibly powerful. Only connect, E.M. Forster once wrote. Live in fragments no longer. Relationship, connection. These words that hold such transformative power, along with several others, which oddly all begin with C, and that we've been pondering on our journey, such as community, cooperation, consultation, and compassion bring me to my long-promised analogy, a metaphor far more apt and relatable than that stupid car one from the last chapter. Here it is, the human body. The human body is one of the most profound and intricate entities that we'll ever encounter, a far more complex and nuanced mechanism than a car. It is also a perfect example of a crucial spiritual concept, one we alluded to briefly in Crafting Soul Boom, the Religion, unity in diversity. A body simply could not be any more diverse. A sloshy bag of skin that contains within it goopy liquids, gigantic bones, and tiny organs that determine all kinds of things. A pump and a bellows right smack dab in the middle of the chest. A cauliflower brain sparked with electrochemical impulses, eyelashes, nerve endings, toenails. All of these components could not be more various and distinctive from one another, and at the same time they are harmoniously linked and operating, most of the time hopefully, with incredible grace and fluidity. The body propels itself, meandering around a shopping mall or a park or a dining room, and meanwhile holds somewhere inside of it the miraculous flame of consciousness. One could compare individuals to cells in the body, independent, yes, but in service to their particular group. Pancreatic cells help a pancreas do whatever it does. Brain cells work together to help the brain do brain stuff. All 37 trillion cells of the human body show flashes of independence. But at the end of the day, they're all working toward a larger unity, that of a body in space, moving, eating, sleeping, and pondering. The natural systems of planet Earth work along analogous lines: oceans, rivers, mountains, forests, clouds, and the biosphere that inhabits those systems. One could say all of humanity, too, is like a body, a single organism of 8 billion cells, individuals, grouped into a myriad of divergent parts, components, and bits and bobs that must harmoniously balance to function as a civilization, interdependent subsystems maintaining their wholeness while laboring toward an even greater wholeness. Just as the health of the body depends on the various component parts all working together in balance, both our planet and our human society need an essential harmony to function with efficiency and grace. And there is more to this conclusion, which we will share at the ending of our next program. As always, I wish you a beautiful, joyous, and peaceful new week, and I look forward to being with you next time on our Philosopher program.